Hey everyone, welcome to this talk on esoteric Christianity between myself and Aaron French. As many of you will know, we are releasing a course specifically on esoteric Christianity, what was come to be defined as esoteric Christianity. And as for the course details, I will overview them at the end of this talk, but basically speaking, this is both a promotional video and also a video really of interest for anyone who is interested in this notion of esoteric Christianity, which is slowly gaining more traction the last sort of 10 or so years via various books, and what we really mean by this, often called a lost Christianity, a hidden Christianity, or something along these lines. Yeah, this is promotion for a course. If at the end of this you are interested in the ideas, there'll be links for the course in the description below, and I will give an overview of the course details at the end. But I think, Aaron, just to begin, I mean, very basic question: what is esoteric Christianity?
Yeah, thanks for the question, and also for I'm very happy that we're releasing this course finally. We put a lot of work into it, and yeah, this question has been part of the whole process. Really, we started perhaps one way and then moved in a certain directions by the end. It's not really an answerable question. I think that's partly the point. So I don't know that we started out wanting to answer it. It's kind of an exploration, really, because it could mean a number of different things to different people, depending on your persuasion, depending on how you interpreted it. So the way that we thought about doing it, which I think was a good idea, is to, because I have a history in the academic study of esotericism, which doesn't have to have anything to do with Christianity, but can. And you have this background also in theory and theology, that we decided to, I would focus a little bit more on bringing in this idea of esotericism, what can it mean? And you're focusing more on theology and theory. That if we brought these two things together, perhaps we could get, we could explore and perhaps even get a bit of a clearer idea about what is being pointed to when someone says, I'm an esoteric Christian, or I'm into esoteric Christianity. And related to this, we had to think about different ways of phrasing it, because if someone says Christian esotericism, it also does not necessarily mean the same thing as esoteric Christianity. So this was another point that we brought in. But, you know, there is like a number of qualities we could associate with esoteric Christianity. One having to do with the focus on inner connection with Christ, inner connection with the divine, something like this. There's also an experiential quality frequently that we point to in the course, that in many cases a person has a personal experience of the Christ in a religious context. Maybe it's angels, maybe it's just sort of light appearing and a voice, you know, like, so this experiential dimension is also definitely a key part of whatever esoteric Christianity is. And just another one that we explore at great length, because this is always coming up, is the appropriation, the reinterpretation of ideas normally associated with like traditional Orthodox Christianity, or even just texts, you know, reinterpreting these texts and ideas in ways that are in some ways contrary to Orthodox traditional Christianity, even though perhaps they're not, but perhaps from the perspective of the institution they are. So this activity you find also as a major thread through whatever esoteric Christianity is. We're going to interpret these texts and these ideas differently a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's in that way, it's a sort of a parallel conversations going on at the all the while, because if you take esoteric to also mean, in a very, very banal, asinine sense, alternative, you know, if you have Christianity on the one hand and then you have this other form of Christianity, to a certain extent, you have to say, well, by doing that, you're saying that there is a correct, anchored, we could say, form of Christianity. And ultimately, I would argue that for most people, okay, there are, you know, I'll step in the minefield right now and say, yes, there are differences in theology between the three primary camps of Christianity, so to speak, Orthodox, Catholicism, and Protestantism. There are emphatically nuances and differences in the theology. That's undoubtable. But even within, especially the first two, Orthodox and Catholicism, there is a theology there which you can consider to simply be the Christian theology in the institutional orthodox, there we go, sense. Before anyone comments and says, look, there's all these differences, there is a theology that I would say which is in a majority agreement about revelation, resurrection, incarnation, Mary, the sacraments, baptism, etc., etc., etc. There is this firm foundation there from which we then progress with the course to enter into how people are interpreting you know, this solidified understanding of Christianity to then veer off into what we'd consider esoteric Christianity. This sort of, well, that's sort of right, but also there's this other thing you guys missed. Or, well, if you read it esoterically, this is actually the real meaning. You know, this sort of classic reappropriation of things. And I guess just to begin to launch into really what is both a history and an investigation into this, and we've tackled about 20 specific thinkers, and then there's five talks on foundational things. So I tackle theology, sort of theology 101. Aaron tackles esotericism. And then we also tackle this notion of heresy, because really, I mean, for a lot of people who say, yeah, esoteric Christianity, that's just a history of heresy. And so this notion of heresy is always throughout this thing as well. But just to begin it, I mean, one of the interesting things that to begin it is you have what I've been calling the Christ event, because there is this emphasis on history as whatever this thing was that happened, this whole event surrounding this and different interpretations and different views of it. It, in a way, the history of esoteric Christianity even begins before Christ, because a lot of esoteric Christians draw on the Essenes, who were pre-Christ and were a very big sect, especially for their day. There was about 8,000 of them, and drawing in this notion of possibly how to read Christ into the Essenes. Now, there's not much historical data for this, but we're trying to balance the course between historical context, taking people at their word in terms of what they're talking about in terms of way later on magic and things like that, but also just the investigation of how this progresses in terms of what it changes for Christianity. So this history really begins before Christ with the Essenes. And just to open up where it begins to split off, and then I'll hand over to you, Aaron. The great irony, I found it just so funny in doing the research for this, is you have Jesus Christ, theologically speaking, you know, just imbued with, let's say, the Orthodox theology. Then you have the apostles, the 12 apostles, known as the first echo. And then you might think, well, you know, if these people knew the apostles, these church fathers who come next knew the apostles, then surely there was no sense that things were going to veer off on the incorrect path. And lo and behold, okay, you have Christ, you have the apostles, and, you know, that just about holds together what Christianity means at that point. And then as soon as you're in that second generation, you have Origen, you have Tertullian, and just, you know, there isn't a second passes before things immediately split, and people such as really Origen is the first I would consider to be the first esoteric Christian, in the sense of, well, you read things this way, here is a highly highly allegorical and analogical reading of all of this, which is, you know, completely, so much of it is completely declared as heresy now. So the beginnings of esoteric Christianity aren't simply this. I mean, this is something to really emphasize. They are not simply this New Age 1800s, when the term finally gets defined. It begins alongside Christianity. That is really how the course begins, is making that fact quite clear.
Right, and that was actually part of the challenge, because the word esotericism, the way it's used now, this is only a couple hundred years old, this term used in this way. Whereas there's another term such as occultism, mysticism, Gnosticism, like all of these other magic, all of these words have in some way something to do with it. But then you have the history of Christianity. So if you start now with what people talk about in terms of esoteric Christianity, you can understand one thing. But we wanted to go back and could we actually try to find some kind of either continuity or at least some kind of like history that's useful and valuable in exploring what esoteric Christianity could be by returning even to the beginnings, to the event, then coming up into the modern times, which is of course a huge swath of history. But nevertheless, I think it's fruitful because the term has so much loaded into it that it needs to be really unpacked in such a way. And so if you have like at the beginnings here, you have, yes, this foundation already of like apocalyptic Judaism and so forth, that then, I mean, the process of forming an Orthodox or traditional version of Christianity, that was beginning right away and ongoing. And the notions, that's why we had to start with things like heresy, and we had to start with the Gnostics, so-called Gnostic groups who are considered heretics. But then you just had kind of schisms. But we needed to start there because it is true that there was a background that you pointed to already before the event, and this has to do with the quote unquote pagan practices that were to some extent either incorporated or rejected, and this depending on the region also, you know, where Christianity was growing or emerging. So this was also was a huge part of the process here. And if you think about the context, this Mediterranean context in which it emerges, of course, I think about the idea of magic, and they like the earliest definition of one of the earliest definitions we have of magic also comes from Plato. You know, there are kind of several ways to think about this, but what Plato talked, the way he talked about magic was he just pointed to the magi of of Persia, the Zoroastrian tradition, and saying that they were just doing false religion. Like we have religion, and so we do it correctly, but they have, that's not religion, it's actually magic, because it's a way of doing religion incorrectly. So there is already, as soon as you get something like Christianity, all these debates about how to do this correctly, how to interpret this correctly, what does it mean? And within these groups that became heretical, that became quote unquote Gnostic, you do find certain kinds of rituals, certain kinds of practices, certain kinds of ideas. That could be considered, yeah, like magic, even either magic or in terms of like theurgic, you know, like practices about self-development and about inner divinity. So even though you find those, of course, in later versions of esoteric Christianity, even here at the beginning, you can find a debate, a discussion, a confrontation with what sorts of practices are going to be allowed to be included as part of this new Christian Christ movement, which at the beginning was just referred to as the way, you know, the early followers. So yeah, that's why we had to kind of, we did start here, and yeah, we went from there.
And I want to draw in you know, a couple of historical things with what you said. This notion, one, with Plato going back to the Magi and saying that they're just doing religion wrong. And in the sense that, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most helpful definitions of magic that comes from Egyptian times is the enunciation of words to bring about a change in reality. And usually this is combined with some form of ritual or ceremony, which John Michael Gray would call psycho sort of like, what does he call it? Dynamically charged, like just psychology, like you're just undergoing this thing. Well, whatever way you want to think about it, magic in that sense of, let's bring it down to the most simple way you can think about it. Saying a certain sentence or a certain string of words to bring about a change in reality. And then this is drawn into that Platonic tradition in a way, or seen with that Platonic tradition of the above and the below, the divine things and the worldly things. And you could think on, in a certain way, you can immediately, of course, think of baptism as you're stating certain words and something is drawn down and the ceremony is taking place and reality has changed on the divine level with respect to there now being a mark on the soul. Now, whether it with also this notion of looking at the word esoteric, so another historical thing to bring in very much from the very, very, very early church, pre-Constantine, before it was sort of completely sort of written into law, or almost to be the religion, is there is pre Constantinian Christianity has esoteric and exoteric practices because of socially contextual reasons. So nowadays, if you one intriguing thing about being in catechesis in the church is that you will notice that if you are a catechist, you are actually saved. If you are undergoing the process of catechesis in the church, you'll notice that if you were to die, you wouldn't go to hell. You would be saved. Now, it sort of doesn't make too much sense now. It sort of makes a little bit of sense, but if you look into the reason as to why that is, it's because pre-Constantine, when it was extremely dangerous to be a Christian, that had to be there because you were really risking your life to be a Christian. Now, what has that got to do with esotericism? Well, esotericism, as the inner work, put in relation to exotericism, the external, so external and internal. Well, the church in the very, very early days would have an external ritual and public face, if you want to put it that way, for either people who are interested or catechists who wanted to become a Christian. But as soon as you entered into the rite of the Eucharist and the mass to do with that ritual, they were asked to leave, and you can consider that to be the esoteric practice. And so this tradition has been there. It's just been very much muddied throughout time, in a way.
Yeah, and that's why it was both fun and challenging to try to go back here to see if we could write about this with esoteric Christianity as our lens, you know, to write, to research it this way and then even present on it. One of the things that you have to do is be very selective, obviously, with what it is you want to talk about. So that was another thing that came up that I think was interesting, because it really made us fine tune our focus in a certain sense. And so we did go back to this beginning period, looking at the controversies over heresy, the institutionalization of the church, and so forth, and then kind of moved into more ideas that, like Pseudo-Dionysius, for instance, like more ideas, I guess, laden with a kind of Neoplatonism or this like late antique religiosity, which nowadays, just in and of itself, could be called esoteric, one could argue. That here you have this is a very rich context in which Christianity and these practices are having a kind of relationship, as the church in its there's just one church at this time, even though there are still kind of schisms off in various places doing their own thing as well, who are technically still Orthodox. But nevertheless, you can find these very interesting other ideas floating around amongst Christians. So then we tried to go and see how that was playing out, like post-Constantine, post-Church Fathers, and so on. And you talked a lot about Pseudo-Dionysius. Mm-hmm. You did a lecture on this, which is really crucial for the whole rest of the whole other people, basically, that we talked about. Mm-hmm. Like this, even though it's a canonical part also of church theology, it's just very interesting. Perhaps it has to do with emphasis, but just how much also Pseudo-Dionysian ideas are just part of all these other esoteric Christian thinkers. But then this brought us into the Byzantine period as well, and we kind of focused a little bit of how heresies, quote unquote heresies, were dealt with in this period, such as Manichaeism and the Byzantine context versus the Latin context, and really like what was going on here, and how did that inform how an esoteric Christianity continued to be noticeable in history, or continued to be a part of it.
Mm. I think Pseudo-Dionysius, the Areopagite, is one of the best examples, because, of course, the two talks that I give pre-Pseudo-Dionysius are on the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Church Fathers. Now, of course, the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Essenes, and the Church Fathers. And, of course, there's a fair amount of writing. There's less writing about the Essenes and the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's one of these sort of contextually actually disappointing places where a small bit of data is really abused for the sake of interest, and this does happen throughout the course, as you can imagine, with the kind of people that we're dealing with, is especially when we get through all the way to the Akashic records, then what do we do with those? But with the Church Fathers, for instance, there is a fair amount of writing. But the reason Pseudo-Dionysius, the Areopagite, is really helpful for our cause is because we have treaties left by him with a lot of extant writing, and in a way a very clear system. And the most sort of, for me, the most important thing with Pseudo-Dionysius is the beginnings of hierarchy. Spiritual hierarchy is absolutely rife throughout this entire course. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone who would be considered esoterically Christian who does not rely on some notion of an above and a below, which is also drawing on the Neoplatonic and really more so Neoplatonic sense of the higher to the lower. And as you move through from Plato through to the Neoplatonists and then through to Pseudo-Dionysius, it just gets more and more and more and more complicated. This hierarchy, which for Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagot, his is one of the first syntheses, or first sort of clear syntheses that we have in relation to what he calls the celestial hierarchy, which is the synthesis of Neoplatonism, but specifically Proclus's Neoplatonic hierarchy and Christianity, so we can finally begin having what I would consider to be almost a backbone and foundation to how it is to be an esoteric Christian, to what is that which is hidden from the above, from going from the below to the above, is basically the foundation we're given. And we see it in Eckhart, we see it in The Cloud of Unknowing, we see it in John Dee, we see it in Swinberry, we see it in Fortune, we see it in Gurdjieff. And of course, if you only read these people, you think, oh, that's a really interesting idea of a hierarchy, but really this notion has been there all along, and Pseudo-Dionysius really sets the theological foundation. Now, you might argue that me and Aaron perhaps are reading modern Christianity in a fairly pessimistic way. Now, I will say, speaking just for myself, I do read modern Christianity in a very pessimistic way, because you don't hear about the hierarchy anymore. You don't hear about levels. You don't hear about what it is to climb the ladder, right? The Christianity of today is deflated and bureaucratic, especially most popular visions. So esoteric, you could say, well, you could make this argument that the stuff we're touching on, well, it's not esoteric, it's not hidden, it's not esoteric, because, well, it is there in the documentation. But in the sense that it has been perhaps just apathetically left to the wayside, this esotericism that we're speaking of is both a retrieval, like a refinding, and then also certain thinkers' reappropriation of events.
Yeah, and part of the reason for us doing that is based on what the people we're studying, what they say. Because many of them say that, and that's why they're doing in whatever it is they do, that they are somehow responding to the institution of the church, or the main representative of Christianity somehow failing, in its ability to maintain this inner esoteric spiritual part of its heritage, or part of its what in their minds part of what it's supposed to be. So one of the reasons why we look at it that way is because many of the people that we're, because there's this sort of battle between who's allowed to represent what Christianity means or not historically, that they're the quote-unquote Christian esotericists are responding to that. So it is true that, like, with Pseudo-Dionysius, for example, even though it's a major backbone of esoteric Christianity, it's also a major backbone, one could say, of just Catholic theology. And yet, the people we're studying, they argue that this element of it has been somehow diluted, materialized, corrupted, left to only an elitist group who get to be the ones who engage with it, and then somehow access is, I don't know, less readily available. So that's a little bit of the reason why we're doing it this way, because one of these elements of esoteric Christianity, perhaps not always, but frequently, it is also can be this, especially with these later, early modern and modern ones, this idea that we're responding to a kind of failure in the part of the church, or perhaps not a failure, but just, something missing. I mean, a lot of these people, they're just needing this spiritual dimension of their life, not finding it in the church. So they go and find it wherever they can, and then make this new kind of Christianity
and then get in trouble. And also, you mentioned this notion of only certain people, sort of a gatekeeping of how to even do this at all. And it's sort of ironic in the sense that with Pseudo-Dionysius, once again, yes, you see this beautiful celestial hierarchy of, like, you know, as an individual, you think, wow, I've got this almost like, I've almost got this step-by-step guide of how to, you know, the ultimate aim for Christians, understood for a long time, the ultimate aim of Christians would have been the medieval definition of contemplation, which would have been, means the unification of the soul with God. I mean, you know, and how do you do that? You get on this ladder and you just start going up. I mean, it's clearly not that cut and dry, but the point being is that Pseudo-Dionysius gives you this celestial, beautiful celestial hierarchy of how to spiritually ascend. But then he's like, well, here's the ecclesiastical hierarchy as well. So he writes these letters to in a strange order, which is symbolic, some people believe. So he writes it to a monk, and then he writes to, like, laity, then a monk, then a deacon, then a, you know, then a priest, then a bishop. You know, he has the hierarchy of letters for each person, but he finishes it with a monk again. I think he's making a little bit of a nod to his own spiritual stuff. But the point being is that on the one hand, he's like, yeah, this is beautiful celestial hierarchy, and then on the other hand, he's like, by the way, here's the ecclesiastical hierarchy that we're going to have for the next 1400 years, and that itself instills almost a mirror image of how that's going to be, and instills a battle which is still is happening throughout Christian history, and explodes, as you'd imagine, which we'll get to soon enough, the Reformation, the battle between immediacy and mediation. So mediation is extremely orthodox. You don't sit down and confess to God one-on-one. You go to a priest who, in the apostolic lineage, is sitting there as almost as an apostle, speaking on or acting on behalf of God. So you have this mediation through a priest, through a bishop, and that whole hierarchy works that way. You know, laity through a monk, laity through a deacon, through a priest, through a bishop, etc., all the way to the Pope. You have that mediation. But then it's sort of frustrating, because on the other hand, you're like, well, yeah, but you've got this hierarchy. Why can't I just sort of jump into this and have an immediate relationship? And you know, the writers, I think, who pre-Reformation, who are getting in trouble, are really the writers who are trying to hide a means for the laity and the means for the average person to have an immediate relationship within their text. And this is why, you know, this is why Eckhart gets in trouble.
Right. Yeah, and just even before going that far, just one other thing, because it isn't that just the ideas of Pseudo-Dionysius are, you know, what esoteric Christianity is. It's a huge part of it that we can identify a common elements and all of these other people we're calling esoteric Christians. That's not it. It's not the only thing. They do, it's like, if in the late antique period, going into the early and late Middle Ages, there is definitely certain other interpretations, certain other beliefs, certain other readings of the Gospels and so forth that other groups try to incorporate into their group. Mm. And this is a problem. Like, you know, how much is an emanationist philosophy allowed to be part of this or not? How much is... are certain rituals of initiation and baptism, how are they to be used? How are they to be interpreted, and who gets to do them? Mm. As we moved into the Byzantine context, one of the things that I wanted to look at, and we got to explore this, because in the Latin world, in the early and late Middle Ages, you have these debates over heresy and so forth. And then you have a different set, but related, happening in the Byzantine and the Eastern Roman Empire. But in both, you can find this charge of Manichaeism coming to the fore a lot. And so the way scholars talk about this is normally a kind of a projection, you know, that because of Augustine having been a member of the Manichaeans in his time and then leaving, arguing against them, that this, like, trope just kind of lived on in the church. And therefore, when groups had some kind of, like, alternative approach, you know, they frequently got this Manichaean label attached to them, which was a heretical label. And for example, in the Eastern Roman Empire, they passed a law that if the Manichaeans would be killed. You know, in the early early Middle Ages, this law was passed in Constantinople that, you know, to be a Manichaean was a capital punishment. Was the
They brought the
punishment.
boot down hard on the mannequins.
Yes.
They were made an example of very
Right.
swiftly.
Yeah. And so some of their ideas, like for example, the Bogomil tradition, if you look at some of the ways they're approaching Christianity, there is an emphasis sometimes on elements that you don't find so much focus on perhaps in the what we think of as orthodox or traditional. And this does sometimes have to do with polarities of light and darkness, the matter and spirit, and the how they correspond to something like light and darkness, and to God and a devil or a Satan figure, and then what the believer, what their position is within that, and what they have access to in order to confront it. And in many of these other groups, rituals, initiations, mystical practices could frequently, perhaps even quasi-magical or just outright magical theurgical practices, also sometimes showing up here. And so we wanted to kind of like, whatever esoteric Christianity is that we're saying it changes. It's not like it's a static thing, but we're sort of watching these moments in history and how the challenges that Christianity undergoes and the things that it is involved in, and how this has affected now how we have people talking about esoteric Christianity, you know?
And I think it's a pretty good place to really begin one of the trajectories of this history that I've found, which is the move from apophatic theology through to post-Reformation individualism. And apophatic theology being this case, really almost like a theological epistemology of God is unknown. So apophatic theology being a theology of negation. What we don't know, what we to know anything about God, we have to realize what we don't know about him. And really, Pseudo-Dionysius is the father of apophatic theology. Then Meister Eckhart is also an apophatic theologian or negative theologian or via negativa. And also the well-known mystical contemplative text, The Cloud of Unknowing, is also an example. I mean, The Cloud of Unknowing is an example of apophatic theology. This notion of, like, at any this is really how this history begins, is the history of something more than simply what we might call, ironically, simply Sunday worship, we could say. Something more than going to church, going to confession, doing your obligations as they are known within certain catechisms, is begins with this apophatic theology. Like, if you want to take it one step further, and I mean, Eckhart emphasizes this, and Cloud of Unknowing, the author, who is anonymous, we don't know who it is, but probably a Carthusian monk, they emphasize, look, this text is not for anyone who hasn't really got the basics down. So in the sense that esoteric Christianity is hidden, it's also something more, but it's more that is hidden. So it's a depth in that way. But the apophatic theology is like a paradoxical depth, because you're entering really into what you don't know. And so the history of this begins with for me, Dionysius, Eckhart, and the Cloud of Unknowing as a what we know about God is so we don't know anything at all. Dionysius would go as far, Pseudo-Dionysius would go as far to say, we can't even call God God, because you're signifying God with a known signifier. This is actually something taken up in The Cloud of Unknowing, where the author of that text goes so far as to say that senses are things we know, but in the sense that language is announced by our blabbering flesh, he says, language itself is something we also know. So any sense of definition, if at any point when you're in the cloud of unknowing, something jumps in, you go, oh, I know what it is. No, that isn't God, because you know it. So it's this constant moval, oh, it's a constant move, sorry, up the hierarchy that we've been given as this foundation via this strange purification. But there's a flip in the history where the purification turns into really like a crystallization, and it flips. And that's the Reformation, which we'll get to. But I don't know if, Aaron, you wanted to just say more about the sort of late Middle Ages era, where the apophatic stuff really comes into full
Yeah,
force.
well, it's interesting because it made me think that there's actually, at the same time as this, and in a certain sense related. I mean, one of the things that I gave a talk on was about the introduction of Kabbalistic ideas in Christianity. It's like leading right into the period of Ficino and Pico, which kind of ends the late Middle Ages, let's say. into the time of the Reformation. Just a slight difference there, which is nonetheless interesting, is that the Kabbalistic practices were happening, or being tr these texts were being translated and studied in Spain, and then you had these persecutions of the Jews in Spain, and many of them had to leave, and so you get this kind of a movement of many Kabbalistic informed Jews into the rest of Europe, and then you find people in Central Europe now wanting to read the Kabbalah and learn about it, and but not just learn it to because they're interested in mystical Judaism or something, but precisely because they're Christians and want to apply it to this Christian religion. And so in that process, you get like a different expression of it's that it's in some ways very strong now, but this is like the background to then when you get Ficino and Pico and their ideas about Christianity, this Christian Kabbalistic background, and the Hebraists who were learning Hebrew and being taught Hebrew by these Jews. This also is a very interesting part. And just how it's somewhat different is that a lot of that practice had to do with actually employing language as a practice.
Mm. Well, I do have a comment on this, but yeah.
Yeah, just to finish there, that you employ the language because you can get these like esoteric names of God coming from this Kabbalistic tradition. And it's through the... And it's a very fine art. It's not like you can just say these names and it'll do something. You have to learn exactly through a kind of like, you know, mystical and esoteric practice, how these words are supposed to be vibrated and said. And it's through that you can achieve these higher levels of absorption into the divine and connection with the divine. But it's actually through the language itself. And this is also then why you find so much emphasis on Hebrew language, not only in this time, but going forward into these later esotericists and occultists, you know, the emphasis on the connections between Hebrew language, Kabbalistic tree of life, which comes around this time also in relationship to Christianity as a way of kind of like deepening it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a peculiar period in time because they're trying to, there is this apophatic side. There is, as you've said, the language side there, but language mm-hmm. actually is a concurrent theme throughout the whole course as well. I mean, beginning with Pseudo Dionysius, really. Pseudo Dionysius also he would say, look, you know, languages he wrote in a very obscure and esoteric fashion to sort of hide the secrets of the mysteries of what was considered sacred in the church away from those who wouldn't understand them. But at the same time, he did understand that we have to use language, and he's really the beginning also of like. In a way, this notion, not specifically the Adamic language, which John Dee, I talk about with John Dee much later on, but he would say, well, we have the divine names. How do we refer to God? And he would say that anytime you refer to God, if it's beauty, goodness, it has to be over goodness, over beauty, or pre beauty, pre goodness, because it's all God is always something more in relation to that hierarchy. God is like the whole hierarchy and above it. There can never be, once again, that would mean entering into the known. And there's almost a sense that there could be some form of language, but it would have to be something beyond, which we see with the Adamic language going all the way back to the Garden of Eden, where Adam is, you know, or God says to Adam to name the animals, and Adam names the animals, but it's understood that he names them, like the names are the essence of the thing itself, and so it's a question of what language was he speaking, and then this is John Dee's great sort of Christian investigation is not only how to find this out, but how to possibly speak the Adamic language.
And well, and some of the Christian Kabbalists, I think, are thinking of Hebrew in these terms also at this time.
Yeah. I think there was the notion that it was that language. There was always the Catholic joke, of course, that it was of course Latin.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I guess we're trying to cover a lot of ground here, but we move, I mean, how would you describe this move from this era, which, I mean, the thing with this era, we've always had to keep the historical context, we maintain the historical context within frame at all times, because it's extremely important. And of course, in this era, I mean, this is almost like a golden era of Christianity, because it's been completely solidified by Constantine. The Reformation hasn't happened. So really what we're looking at is a culture just completely, well, at least the culture we're talking about, is there isn't too much cultural divergence away from it at all, and people are being still, trying to retain a very orthodox stance. But how would you explain, why it is it moves, and where are we moving to?
Well, I mean, the quote unquote Renaissance period, that's where all of this supposedly leads, with the period you're talking about, which the word Renaissance means rebirth. So the implication is that even though there was this sense, as you're describing, this like more kind of like free access or just sort of a take it for granted kind of access or being embedded in this worldview and this tradition, that somehow this is associated also with the decline and the notion of the Dark Ages, and which we don't need to get into all that. But that's why the Renaissance was thematized as like this is somehow a rebirth of culture out of that stagnation or that decline. And what do you find happening there? Well, you have the Kabbalistic element is coming in right about this time, and then you have also the astrological focus again. And we're going to Florence, obviously, for the Renaissance. But so in the work of Ficino and Pico, you then find the Hermetic texts. This is the argument, at least, and we kind of put some pressure on this in the talks. But it's nevertheless there are elements of it which are part of the story, that Hermeticism comes back, Platonism comes back, astrology comes back, natural magic comes back, and now here's Kabbalah. So it's like these five elements are suddenly there with the church. And so, like Ficino and Pico embodying all of these elements, still being Catholic, but of course, running up against a lot of difficulties at the same time. So, again, we're having this idea about who's doing the religion right, or not, and who's doing magic. And of course, if you read these people like Clethon or Ficino rather, and Pico, they are talking, I'm not doing demonic magic. I'm not doing necromancy. I'm doing natural magic. It's okay. It's part of the religion. But what we tried to focus on there is like how we've talked about Plethon, the Gemistus Plethon, coming from Constantinople, giving this lecture in the 1400s in Florence. Cosimo de Medici hears this lecture, gets all excited, has Ficino then start getting interested in getting Platonic texts somehow and translating these. So we tried to argue that that's also like there's a moment of like convergence of some kind here in this like Renaissance period we're talking about. And then after that, it's a different animal we're looking at. It retains many of these same qualities, but it has like gotten a whole new face. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean it's sort of like it's the almost like the pre-Reformation in a way that the you there's a I mean if, when we think about for instance Ficino's own spiritual hierarchy, which is highly Platonic, of course. He centers the individual within the hierarchy. So there's this, as you said, like a convergence of grace and individuality. So we've moved away from an era which was very much far more emphatic within the text of grace, of God being almost like the full controller. And of course, theologically, I imagine they would have still understood it in the theological sense if they were being very orthodox as this is still God doing it, but there is an emphasis on the individual's place within things, which then just bolsters and bolsters as we enter into the Reformation. And we also see here, the Renaissance, we see the birth of magic. We also see, well, not the birth of magic, but we see magic becomes a bit more rigorously defined. And we also see elements of magic that are going to be sort of drawn from later on. It's always a case of drawing and drawing and drawing back through history. We also see the entry with Ficino of a Christian form of, well, he would call it Prisca Theologio, where he says that all these thinkers or mystics, Hermes Trismegistus, I think Pythagoras, Plato, are a lineage leading up to Christ, who, in very roughly speaking, got close but weren't the full thing, and then Christ is the full sort of the full deal. And of course, some of the thinkers that we'll be dealing with later on would probably argue that trajectory hasn't fully finished, that there are still people appearing on Earth who are something more. You certainly see that in the New Age movements. I think I was reading just last night, it's a Jiddu Krishnamurti that they believe that he was possibly like, we hear this
The
commonly in,
Maitreya Buddha, right?
well, the next,
Next Messiah.
the common next Messiah type deal. So yeah, we have this Prisca Theologia, which I think needs, in a way, is a some people said, why is there no, something to add in here, I think, is why is there no René Guénon and the traditionalists? And it's because they call their work Christian esotericism in the perennial tradition of, which is different. Very difficult to explain why, but the perennial tradition, Prisca Theologia leads up to Christ, and as I understand it, the perennial tradition would consider Christ to be one of many in terms of something much larger, and Guénon having that understanding of just trying to find some Abrahamic religion to adhere to.
And many of our individuals are also innovating things. Like, so the traditionalists definitely were not interested in innovation. They were looking for a kind of, you know, well, traditional expression of these things, but not all of the esoteric Christians that we're looking at, but a great deal of them are innovating, are also innovative. So, and they often see themselves as this, as somehow leading the next phase, you know, kind of attaching something new to this wisdom tradition line you're talking about. I think that's also why they get in trouble, like someone like Foucault, you know what I mean? Because he is arguing like we are coming into a new time, you know?
Well, almost, I'm just looking, I mean, almost all of these people got in trouble in some sense. The people, I mean, right. Oregon sort of got in trouble, definitely got in trouble retrospectively. Tertullian eventually moved over to Montanism. Meister Eckhart almost had to have a audience with the Pope to explain away his work, and he had to. He did have an Inquisition, all for actually fairly tame stuff, to be honest. But he certainly shoots himself in the foot very often. And of course, once we get past the Reformation, there's no point even. There's no need to even say these people were.
Right.
John Dee went. Eliphas Levi, who we do a talk on, was imprisoned. John Dee was imprisoned. Swedenborg, of course, very controversial. And then beyond that point, the sort of almost legalistic dogma where you could seriously get in trouble for things is sort of gone. So,
in the 19th century, something really kind of changes there. So maybe then we could just move into that's like leading up to the Renaissance, forms a kind of first section. And then we're looking at the Reformation, post-Reformation, and into like modern esoteric Christianity, which carries all of this background with it and uses some of it, reinterprets some of it, and at the same time innovates a lot of it. New things are happening. New types of organizations and political contexts are also informing it. The introduction of science is also huge, at least like modern science, modern experimental science. The introduction of this becomes a key part of a lot of these, the thinking of a lot of these figures. But maybe we could just say one thing about Luther. In a certain sense, Luther is like the modern Christian esotericist. Even though like no one would really, we're not talking about him this way, but just as one example of this, like he, when he goes to Rome, he's, you know, filled with all these great ideas about how Christianity is and about how great it is to be, you know, to be a priest and a monk and all of this. And then when he visits, he has this like reaction to what he sees as like a corrupt environment, you know, focusing on things like power and money and whatever. And then when he comes back to Germany and starts like this other way, which has to do much more with like individual, non-mediated, personal experience of Christ. Why I think that that's so important, even though he's not technically an esoteric Christian, he kind of represents the move to modern esoteric Christianity. Just as an example of this, he, in the town where I live in Germany, he became a monk here in the Augustina cloister. And this is before he went and took his trip to Rome. But the symbol of Lutheranism here is a cross with a rose blooming on it. That's Luther's symbol, you know? And in the church here where Luther was a monk and where he preached, even in the stained glass that goes back to the 1300s, I think, and still original, in the bottom corner, there is a image of a cross with a rose blooming out of it. And some scholars think that this is where Luther first saw this image, this symbol, and then later used it as a symbol of evangelical Lutheranism. And of course, the Rosicrucian movement and later esoteric Christians use this symbol with the rose and the cross. And for them, it means like that old, more like institutionally informed version of Christianity is over. The cross blooming on the rose means like the cross blooming without inside of you, the Christ, sorry, blooming inside of you. And it really just means now it's time for like inner connection, immediate access to Christianity. And of course, all these thinkers after that are really talking about that a lot, you know?
Yeah, and I think, it's absolutely unsurprising that the Reformation is the explosion which really splits our... Well, there's a few explosions, but the Reformation is definitely the biggest explosion that sort of splits intellectually, just, you know, here you go do what you want. I was mentioning to you actually earlier that there is a trajectory there which becomes also very peculiar, in the sense that, speaking historically, we begin with Genesis as a single oneness. Meister Eckhart would call it that, as a oneness. We're kicked out of the Garden of Eden because we're sinful and wretched, and we begin with almost Abraham as the father of fathers, everyone, and then we move through to nations, we move through to tribes, then we move through to small groups, Sadducees, Pharisees, and we move through to the apostles with Christ, and then Christ brings about the message of salvation, which is a very individual message. But then as we move through from there through to like the Reformation, it stays about the same. It's very much the individual saving themselves via the media experience within the church, saving your soul within the mediated experience via a priest, via a deacon, via a bishop in the church, via the institution of the ecclesiastical hierarchy. Now, when the Reformation happens, it seems like, well, surely it won't change all that much. It's just going to be more individual, which it certainly is. But there's a strange inversion, because the Reformation actually opens the way, in a very peculiar sense, for individuals to almost become their own little contextual Abrahams. And we see, you know, not only does it open the way for individual Christianity, like having your own thoughts and feelings and experiences, but it opens the way for new appropriations, which basically gives birth to lodges, cults, sects, Freemasonry, you name it. And we actually see a strange inversion from this like hyper-individualism to a rebirth of people. Actually, it's odd that it sort of, as it masses of people here coming down to the Reformation, it then begins again in small groups. Then there are people who think that their work is there to save nations. And then there are people who think their work is there to save the world. And then there are, even way down the line, there is people who would say that there is the work of humanity as a whole once again. And so it's a weird slope that the Reformation in its individualism opens up the course again for this almost Abrahamic utopianism.
Right.
So it's a very peculiar moment in history.
It's a good point, though, that it does two things, this Reformation moment. It forces the whole experience inner, which then has the equal but opposite effect of forcing the whole thing suddenly to be projected outward again. And it takes a little bit of time, but within like 100 years, you know, you are then getting these kinds of ideas about esoteric Christianity in relation to visions of a utopic society, a utopic future, saving humanity, healing humanity. Like some of the people that I focused on, or at least one person I focused on in this period following Luther, was Jakob Burma. And it is true that for him, part of the reason why he had these experiences and these ideas about Christianity was in response to watching the 30 Years' War. So there is like this, okay, you're thrust fully back on yourself, and yet the world is not getting better. In fact, it's changing dramatically. It's getting worse, technology, wars. So then you're almost somehow like, yeah, from out of yourself, then confronted with this and thinking how to heal this, you know. And if you're having your own ideas about healing yourself and connection to Christ, so yeah, then you could project this also in a social sense, cultural sense, universal sense, this kind of thing. And I think the other people we're looking at, like even Swedenborg, and then this period ends with Eliphas Levi, who clearly had a Christian utopian occult new age for the world idea informing his version of Christianity. But it's like a slow progress. Like Jakob Burma, you have a little bit of that, because he's like looking at the 30 Years' War and thinking, aha, this dualism is this light and darkness struggle, I kind of see what's the problem here. Like, here's how you can, I think here's how you could heal it. And then this, you know, this kind of trajectory continues. And then you get the Eliphas Levi, who is like socialism and esoteric Christianity and occultism, and we're off.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at it in that sense, it's a peculiar trajectory because you're beginning with the quaint church fathers, and then you're ending up with Baphomet at a certain point. But, yeah, I mean, you know, Levi is like, the Reformation is the explosion which allowed another shockwave down the line, which is certainly Levi. You know, Levi is a huge shockwave into that forms what we really now know as a lot of the language we utilize around magic occultism is from Levi, and it opens up an even more intensified practical way for individuals to enter into those. Once again, I mean, it's still the same thing. I mean, this is why this course is formed how it is as a linearity, is because, well, we're still doing the same things. It's just almost like given more tools, given more functions, things have opened up more. And this notion of like what once was contemplation, unifying the soul with God, well, you just need grace, sit down, pray, enter into the institution, do your thing, don't question anything, now is sort of like we move into the era of here is like the most intense amount of data and tools you could imagine. And so you have all these strange movements where it's apophatic theology of we know nothing, we can't know anything about God, all the way through to like Gurdjieff, who was talking about down to the level of the hydrogen, just how much we can work out what we're doing. And of course Steiner writing more than any human probably ever did. You know, we move from unknowing to really human reason having a pretty high seat in our salvation, especially as we move post Levi.
Right. Yeah, and one thing we should mention then, in leading up to Levi, and then we'll leave him and go into modernity proper, I suppose. It's like the Reformation and its individualism, but then it has the rise of experimental science in combination with French Revolution, so-called Enlightenment, and this awareness that with our reason, we can apparently, according to the experimental scientists, find out the truth about reality and how the universe functions and produce massive amounts of highly advanced technologies that seem to fix everyone's problems. This also is right at Levi's. I mean, Levi is, this is also informing his ideas, because he wanted to synthesize religion and science through magic, was part of his project. At the same time, he was an esoteric Christian and never really left being a Christian, and always said he was doing true Catholicism. So, but I think what after him, though, it gets much more intense. So if we leave him and go into modernity and new age, now, like, he's beginning to take, okay, reason, science, personal experience, individual, versus this apophatic approach you're talking about. But yes, then when you get the modern cult revival, so-called, Rudolf Steiner, A.E. Wade, the Golden Dawn, Crowley,
John Dee,
right?
I mean, come on, the man's summoning Saint Michael the Archangel, you know. I mean,
right.
this is
yeah, that's true. I mean, he's a bit earlier, but he's also absolutely doing the same kind of activity.
Yeah, but he's you know, he's still in the era where you could get seriously punished, I guess. So that's probably one of the key historical contexts to keep in mind, is like, you know, once you move into the era, like about Swedenborg, but definitely.
Right, because you're right. The John Dee is doing that in a major way. Levi is doing it and still getting in trouble, kind of, sort of, you know. But then after that, there does reach a certain point where you don't have to really worry about it. Just do the whole shebang, you know. Yeah, and then you really get like Gurdjieff, who's like, okay, well, here's the whole systematic way to do it. I've outlined the whole thing. It's 10 volumes, and you can speak about it in an esoteric sense, speak about it in a Christian sense, but also speak about it in a scientific sense, speaking about energies and atoms. And Steiner also does this a lot. All the theosophists do that. Not all the theosophists were esoteric Christians, but a lot of them were also, and coming out of that environment, which was an environment steeped in esotericism and science together.
And I think this last sort of the last fifth of the course, modernity, was probably the area that where we had to grind down who to choose the most. We had to find the people who were, you know, were these esotericists, were occultists, but were far more emphatic than others with respect to making it clear that they really do have a trajectory from Christianity. Dion Fortune makes this very, very clear. Gurdjieff is actually one of the you know, more solid figures who says this is literally called esoteric Christianity. It's what he calls his work at certain times. And of course, Emanuel Swinberry and Rudolf Steiner, because there is this whole history of why isn't Crowley here? Why mm-hmm. isn't there a talk on theosophy? There's many little things there, but
Evgeny Passant, who has a book called Esoteric Christianity, we did not include this.
It would be too easy.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's kind of not in a certain sense. That's also why, even though she has this book, it's not her main thing. She just has a book that happens to be called that. Mm.
And so, I mean, that's the trajectory of the course, and where it finishes is a talk on Valentin Tomberg, and what the course really does is what the spiritual hierarchy that we spoke about right at the beginning does itself, which is fold back around on itself, which is what a lot of these thinkers end up doing. A lot of these thinkers, barring the very early ones who are still steeped in clear institutional tradition, a lot of these thinkers have a biographical trajectory of beginning pious, something happens, and they go radical for a long time and go absolutely, you know, do whatever they can really within their day. And then they get to maybe their 40s or 50s, and then they grab all the radicalness and they fold it back around to understand the piousness which they began their life with as a Catholic or as a Christian. Dion Fortune really does this. Eliphas Levy does this. And the course does this with Tomberg, Valentin Tomberg, who, you know, goes right through the ringer of esotericism. And then the final thing he writes, though some people, you know, it's known as anonymous, but we know he wrote it now, is Christian Meditations on the Tarot, an introduction mm-hmm. to Christian Hermeticism, taking every single thing he learned in almost that Prisca theologian tradition of Ficino and bringing it like back round to go, that was right all along. It was right all along, but you guys didn't have it right. Like, you guys don't know how to really read it. You know, you don't know what the symbols actually mean. And almost right. in a way, like, you had to cross this esoteric abyss and then bring that back mm-hmm. to understand the thing truly.
And was he already a Catholic at the beginning of his life, or did and he just went sure. back I'm to a church sure. or should sure. he convert?
I think he converted, but yeah,
so he converted okay. also. Yeah, and he was bringing then all of these, this whole background going back to the institution. That's our point here. And that's just an interesting, that's where we kind of end on, not to make any sort of statement with that, but just to sort of like show you one sense where this ended up, that there is a kind of cyclical element of this that's interesting to think about. And there's that famous mm-hmm. picture of Pope John Paul with Tomberg's book on his desk and his hand is mm-hmm. sitting, you know, on the book. And that's,
yeah,
that's just interesting to think about like, wow, what a strange way for this history in a certain, it's not exactly how the history ended, but it's how part of the history ended. And it's part of the story of esoteric Christianity. And that's why we wanted to end it there, more to open up for more questions rather than to have a kind of conclusion, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, that's what the course is going to be about. That's really how we're understanding esoteric Christianity. So I'll give an overview of the course and then perhaps we could just discuss how we're going about it a little bit. But there'll be full course notes for all the talks. And then part one, it's theology, esotericism. So these are separate talks, theology, esotericism, comparative history, then Saint Irenaeus and common heresies. Then we move through to part two, antiquity, the Essenes and the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Gnostic Gospels, the beliefs of the early church fathers, theology of Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite, and then a talk. Then me and Aaron finish each section with a talk between both of us. This one is on Manichaeism, Byzantine Christianity, and then early Christianity in general, that sort of primitive Christianity. Part three, the late Middle Ages, is Meister Eckhart, then the Cloud of Unknowing, then Christian Kabbalah, the work of Paracelsus, then Plephon, Thecino, and a move through to sort of an early modernism. Then we have post-Reformation and the early modern. So we have Jakob Burma, John Dee, Swedenborg, Jean-Marie Bouvier de la Mont-Guyon, Carl von Eckharthausen, and then talk between us both on Eliphas Levy and the dawn of occultism. And then right at the end, you know, the final explosion, Anna Kingsford, Rudolf Steiner, Dion Fortune, George Gurdjieff, and then we finish with Valentin Tomberg, modern esotericism, and really a short discussion on the New Age. Because The trajectory of esoteric Christianity, I don't believe, is finished. I would say one of the clearest, most recent attempts at esoteric Christianity is actually the book The Power of the Subconscious Mind by Joseph, I can't remember his name, but he actually draws on the power of the subconscious, always in relation to gospel passages. But at this point, I mean, once you get past Tom Berg, in the sense that he's still in that parallel between how to deal with like orthodoxy and not, beyond that, it explodes a bit too much to be able to deal with. So we finish at a point that we felt was sort of had this, still was having the same conversation.
You could do a course on postmodernity and esoteric Christianity. That would be the next, would be something.
Yeah, I mean, you do a course through from like Tom Berg through to chaos magic, and you'd have another,
right.
You'd
have, it'd be something different.
You'd have all of this again, just in that short period. That's the problem with it.
Yeah.
But
I think that's why you're right. That's why we ended with Tom Berg, that it's a good place to stop, at least this part of the story.
Yeah. So the course will go live on from the 26th of May, and there is two price points, I guess. If you want the whole course, which is 25 lectures, about over 30 hours of talks that you keep for your lifetime, you can download them all and have them on your own PC. You have lifetime access. About 30 hours of content plus the course notes, which will give all the books we used and all the quotations and all this kind of thing. That is $250. And then if you want that plus two group discussion sessions with me and Aaron, which are on the August 12th at 7 p.m. GMT, and September 23rd, 7 p.m. GMT. Those dates will be on the course. Make sure you can attend them. Then that's $400 for the course plus those two talks. Once again, of course, you keep all of it for a lifetime. And the course will, when this goes live, this will be this talk you're now listening to will be live on the day when the course is live. So if this discussion that we've had about what esoteric Christianity interests you, then find a link for the course in the description below. And if you're still on the fence about whether or not this is something for you, in the course, if you open it up, there'll be also a link. Of the 25 talks, four of them are available for free. One from like very early section, one which is a discussion between me and Aaron, and then one from us each just to get a feel for it. They are available for free. So if you're still on the fence, go and listen to them. And also, I would clarify that if you buy the course and you're not happy with it, full refunds, no questions asked. So all the details are at esotericchristianity.co, and hopefully this will be something you guys are interested in. I mean, Aaron, is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, just one last thing, that the way it's structured is we give lectures with slides for a great deal of them, but then each section is a discussion. So it's not like you're just sitting there having to listen to lectures. There's many lectures, but then there is a discussion like this one about a specific topic as well. So you get like a mixture there. And the way that we wanted to have it, the course be, and we accomplished this, is that this will appeal to a variety of people, not just Christians and not just esotericists. In fact, the way we've tried to present it all so that there is something here for both. If there's someone who's just a Christian interested in their faith, the history of Christianity, you will find things of interest here. If you're a person who not so much interested in Christianity per se, but really interested in esotericism, you will also find a lot of very interesting material in terms of that history. And really, even if you're just someone who's interested in history and the relationship between religion and esotericism is an aspect of religion that's usually neglected or not so much considered, this is also a course for you, because it's a really interesting approach, different kind of lens on just European history, and Western history, let's say, in general.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it will be live right now. The links will be in the description below. If you have any questions about the course and how it works, but it is lifetime access, the fees are there. It is full refund if it's not you not what you're expecting, full refund, no questions asked. The links are in the description below, or email me at hermeticspodcast@protonmail.com. If you have any questions as to how it works or things not working or whether or not it's right for you, just email me. But if this has interested you, then please give it a look, because it supports both mine and Aaron as sort of independent scholars, and it also supports Hermetics, and it also, you know, supports this kind of, dare I say it, scholarship, which is tough to find, because you're not going to be bogged down with academic spiel where you're just going to feel a bit exhausted. We don't treat this history with a historicization where we're like, we don't believe any of it. You know, we're taking these thinkers at their word, but at the same time drawing in the historical context and trying to treat everything very fairly. But at the same time, you know, it's a course which is meant to be entertaining and really just open up a sort of a personal intrigue into this course as an interest, and not some sort of very didactic study. But it is all cited and researched. So if it's something that interests you, you know, please give it a look, because it's something that interests you.